So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
Undertaker.
Here comes it coming.
Oh, Michaels in midair.
Michaels caught.
Stone. Pile driver.
My second.
Michaels caught in midair. Two stone.
It's in it.
17 and 17 and 0.
Gentlemen, Shawn Michaels proved tonight that he was indeed Mr. WrestleMania. But The Undertaker proved that he is WrestleMania's phenom.
Well, yes, The Undertaker proved that he is now 17-0.
Indeed, sometimes it's hell getting to heaven.
I feel like we're just in heaven.
Hello, 1-2-1-2-1-2.
I'm here. Welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting with you on this Friday as we are going to be reviewing WrestleMania 25.
Mm-hmm.
Which I was not sure you would get through this week, Wei, when you told me you hadn't even started it.
Ah, well,
this
you know,
4-hour beast of a show.
I feel like I've conditioned my mind and my body to last at least 3 hours a week consistent without having taken breaks every Monday.
Well, this was commercial free though. This is four solid hours.
This is a different beast. In the time that it took me to watch this, I feel like I could have watched like 3 episodes of SmackDown.
You could have.
4 hours. 4 hours straight through. But, you know, you train your body. You train really hard. I brought in the best coaches. Had the best weight cut of my life, and I just did it.
Well, clearly there were lessons to be learned, though, from this WrestleMania, which maybe that could be applied to WrestleMania, like medleys.
Okay. You think this Tasha will do a medley?
What's her name? Tanash?
Tanash.
I think.
I don't know if Tanash really has...
Remy Ma.
I don't know if Tanash really has the back catalog of hits that Kid Rock does.
Well, you know? That's debatable as well.
What you can't. I've never heard of Tanash.
Like, before. Of Kid Rock, when I think of hits, okay, there was the All Summer Long.
Yeah.
Ba with a Ba.
Yeah. Cowboy is a big one. American,
kind of.
American Badass.
Yeah, I guess
a big
he's had some.
Yeah.
They're recognizable, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't look at Kid Rock as this.
What?
This guy that we've been graced with the presence of excellence from 1999 until today. I mean, where does Kid Rock rank in amongst the
Kid Rock
musical contributions of the last 2 decades?
Well, I mean, okay, are you trying to suggest Kid Rock and putting him against like Prince or the Beatles? No, that's ridiculous.
Okay, so already he's not great, is what you're saying.
Well, he's more of a kind of a poppy mainstream type of new metal type of guy.
Like,
but I clearly
don't hang out with the crowd or am in the right parts of the world or drive through Detroit. But I, in my life, the words, dude, Kid Rock's in town, that's never been entered. They've never.
Not even in like 1999 or 2000, whatever he hit?
No. I don't think I've ever met anyone that told me, oh man, Kid Rock.
Well, you're not hanging out with the right people.
Our friend Justin likes Kid Rock. Which says it all right there.
He also loves Nickelback.
He does,
so
yeah.
Maybe there's a bit of a crossover there. But you can't deny that Kid Rock is a very big success in music.
Yeah. He is?
Yes.
Kid Rock was I remember once on Much Music when the whole Napster thing was happening. And everyone was so against Metallica.
Yep.
And Kid Rock said, I get paid. I don't care. And everyone was like, yeah. Yeah, we can steal because Kid Rock said it's cool.
Does he still get paid? I guess with touring and whatnot. You know, like he's somebody who I feel like is really to be respected. The way he transitioned from nu metal, rap rock, to country.
Yeah.
And became incredibly successful at both. You don't see Korn doing that.
No.
You know, what's Fred Durst doing these days? He's not performing at WrestleMania.
If he had gone country, could you have imagined? Break stuff, y'all.
No, I can't. Can't imagine that.
All fall long with Wes Borland and
I don't know.
Fred Durst together.
All fall long, okay. But like they say like country, I don't know if this is true anymore, but for a long, long time when, you know, kids were downloading music, it was the country fans that were still buying records.
Yeah.
And so as a business decision, I thought.
Oh, very smart on it.
Very smart.
Listen, if I were to do some significant research on kid rock,
yeah,
I'm sure I would come away very impressed. But he's not someone that jumps out at me.
He's no Aqua, is what you're saying.
No. No Aqua. I don't think this guy would fare very well going overseas for a tour.
I don't know.
In the middle of Europe. Which Aqua could do tomorrow. They could sell out the arena of your choice.
I don't know about that.
Oh, man.
I don't even know if they could sell out.
Can you imagine Aqua?
Yeah.
At the O2 arena. I mean.
Damn, wow.
That would be just amazing. What a, like an arena that was built for.
Yeah. I mean, not really. You'd have to add a hydrogen in there.
H2O is water, and then there's one that if you take out one specific element, you die from. Is that
carbon monoxide?
Yeah, but it's what's the actual like chemical?
Shit, I don't
symbol.
Know,
I'm trying to remember.
CO2?
It's like H2O, and if you remove
CO2,
it might be. It might be. It's like the difference of one thing. Maybe it's.
Oh God, I don't even know.
I did not do chemistry.
This is why we're in radio and television. We didn't do so well in math and science.
Thanks for the cookie.
Yeah. Hey, everybody. It's John Pollock's birthday.
Yesterday.
But we're celebrating this morning. So everybody wish John Pollock at I Am John Pollock a very happy birthday.
That's not necessary.
If you want to even take the extra step, direct message him. Happy birthday. Because he might not always get your notifications. If you want to go a step even further than that, you can message him on Facebook directly. He loves that. If you want to even take it a step further, here's his phone number, 416.
Well, next Tuesday, I want everyone to add Waiting on Facebook and write on his wall. Can I write on your wall?
No, I've disabled it.
Yeah, me too. Smart. Well, everyone contacts you on Tuesday for your big day, Wade.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And our ages are always so easy for wrestling fans to remember.
Yeah, we are sun this year.
Yeah, we are turning sun this year. Yes, after a great year as stars.
Mm-hmm. But what about our 25th anniversary? That was a great year, wasn't it?
Yeah, our 25th anniversary would have actually taken place in 2009, in March of 2009, because it actually was our 25th anniversary.
What?
We turned 25. WrestleMania was having their 25th event.
Yeah. Right. Because
so we
because,
were the only ones who could claim an anniversary in 2009.
Because WrestleMania 1 was in 1985 when we turned 1.
Yes. So they were celebrating their silver anniversary a year early.
Well, you know what? They could have fixed this whole entire issue if they could have claimed that there was a WrestleMania 0.
But there wasn't.
Maybe in the backyard of Vince McMahon's house.
Maybe they could have called the war to settle the score, WrestleMania 0.
Okay.
Madison Square Garden.
Sure.
Something.
That kind of works.
I know that everyone thinks this is one of my just crazy, like, oh, such a nitpicker. This is like a massive, massive campaign. Imagine the Super Bowl doing this for something that was so mathematically incorrect. There's no gray area with numbers. It's either right or it's wrong.
Yeah.
And this is... I don't. Stupid.
I don't even think it's a math issue. It's more of an improper use of the word.
Completely.
And they have a responsibility, you know, beyond marketing to teach people how to use English properly.
It's like not. It would be like doing WrestleMania and you forget the M.
It just makes the company look dumb, really.
I think so. Yeah. But so many people
stop
complaining.
Because people are dumb. Those people don't know better. To this day, there are people arguing on our YouTube about this issue.
They've corrupted these people's just sense of
goddamn numbers.
All these Kid Rock listeners on YouTube complaining. It is the 25th anniversary. What's wrong with you guys?
You listen. I love all of our listeners, but if you argue, and especially the ones of you that argue with such venom when you are arguing incorrectly about basic numbers, we're not even talking about the hundreds of thousands. We're talking about the number 25. And you can't comprehend that? You're a fool. I'm sorry. Like, you literally fit that category that I cannot fathom how you can make that public declaration and not understand that. It would be like me convincing Wei on YouTube that the letter C is the fifth letter of the alphabet. I'm sorry. If I'm making that argument, I'm an idiot. There's no wiggle room here. It's a great thing about numbers.
Yeah.
They are an exact science,
mm-hmm.
which is not exactly what our campaign was here for the 25th WrestleMania. Are you ready to chat about this show?
Did you
finish it?
I did finish it.
What did you think about the dark match between Primo and Carlito against John Morrison and The Miz, which got bumped the day of the show to the pre-show?
That I did not see.
Neither did I.
Where did you?
And I had the DVD actually that had this match, but I did not go back and watch it. Mm. It was a lumberjack match to get everyone on the show, and they didn't get on the show. They were bumped for Kid Rock.
Do you anticipate any? I mean, they got a kickoff now, so
they now have really announced bumping? A 2-hour kickoff for this year's show, followed by the 4-hour WrestleMania, and still we're looking at 13 to 15 matches.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's totally going to be – I think you're going to have at least 3 matches on the pre-show, if not more.
But there's nowhere to bump somebody if you already have a kickoff card set. If anything, you might kick them off the show completely, like what happened to the Brodus Clay that year.
Well, when you look at some of the undercard matches, like Austin Aries and Neville, even on the pre-show, which is where I imagine it ends up, I could see that getting 8 minutes.
Yeah.
And you're – Raw tag title match, rush job.
Yeah.
Maybe. You also, we listed off all those matches this week, and it could be maybe 15. We're not remembering the fact that the New Day has to have all their skits.
Tanash.
Tanash has to play. Who knows if someone shows up. Imagine they have Dwayne Johnson come back again like last year. Yeah. He did a half hour last year.
Yeah. And it was great.
Oh, it was awful.
What? It was great. The Luke Harper or the Eric Rowan thing?
Yeah, I wasn't a fan of
what?
Rock stuff last year.
I thought it was awesome.
Went on forever.
Oh, come on. It's The Rock.
The John Cena cameo we got there too. Yeah. I don't look back at that WrestleMania fondly. It's like a...
To be honest, I don't remember it all that well.
Do you remember what the main event was? What went on last?
Give me a sec. Roman Reigns? No, that wasn't
and?
It. Roman Reigns and,
so that was WrestleMania 32.
Fuck, what was it? It wasn't Brock. That was the year before.
That was the year before.
So it was Roman Reigns and, don't tell me. Don't tell me. I got this. Roman Reigns and, Triple H. Oh my God. Wow.
A memorable WrestleMania.
Really tough. Really hard.
As we are going to probably spend some time on this show discussing one big match that is most remembered with this event, do you see any match having that potential this year to be a classic?
Hmm. Well, we kind of had a similar discussion on Review of SmackDown this week.
Let's do it again.
But when you just kind of lay it out there, the matches to really watch out for that could be potentially great, I think are – I certainly think Triple H and Seth Rollins has the potential to be as good as Taker and Shawn Michaels. Probably not. AJ, I would usually say, but I mean him against Shane McMahon, I don't really expect that.
I could see Taker and Shawn being eclipsed by Shane.
Nah, I don't see that happening.
I'm not as negative on that match.
Not anymore. Yeah, well, we've accepted it. You know,
well,
but imagine if you just found out about it.
Well, when I first did hear about it, listen, I thought, man, this is an unfortunate use of AJ, but I wasn't like when I first heard Shane and The Undertaker, I laughed it off because I was like, there's no way they're going to do that match. They did that match.
They did the match, and it was 90% of it was awful.
It was.
Until he fucking dove off the thing.
I was way more angry about that one and just what a – but you know what? That match, a lot of people got into. This year, you know, I feel for AJ. I would much rather see him have a classic with someone, but there's not a whole lot of options there. And I have way more curiosity to see what AJ can do with someone as limited as Shane.
Sure.
As opposed to Undertaker last year with Shane, that I just – I was not a fan of that. I mean
– yeah. When you go up and down the card, I mean, you know, just thinking about what else can potentially be this level of match, I don't know – I don't think there are many options. You know, Taker, Roman, I don't see it being that as good as Shawn
Taker.
That could
turn out good.
Yeah, but it's also a really high bar to expect, you know, for a match to on any show anywhere to be as good as Taker versus Shawn.
Yeah, I feel that, you know, Taker and Shawn in this year, people went in with high expectations, but I don't think they were expecting the level of what they got.
Right.
I think they exceeded everyone's expectations as well. So this show, despite like a build that we have gone over, that was hardly an overwhelming one. I mean.
Yep.
Maybe that's why I'm a little more high on this year's WrestleMania is our time dedicated to this 2009 build, which dude. I think this year's is blowing away the 2009 build up.
The Raw and SmackDown reviewed 2 weeks ago, just they sucked.
Like I was looking forward to Taker and Shawn, but that's also, you know, in hindsight how good the match was.
Yeah. How great was the build itself, in your opinion? The light versus dark thing.
It was fine. It wasn't unbelievable.
Right. Yeah.
It was fine.
It was okay.
Yeah. But you look at the, like, Orton and Hunter, awful. The legend stuff. I think Chris Jericho did a pretty good job with his promos. I had no interest in Edge, Cena, and Big Show. And what was the other title? Oh, yeah. Orton and Hunter would have been the other title match. I mean, we go up and down here. I mean, this money.
The Hardys?
The Hardys. Yeah. That to me. No one was connected to once you were doing all their ridiculous stuff.
Mm.
What an interesting tie-in. We picked this year with the Hardys and, you know, having – this would have been Jeff's final WrestleMania appearance.
Yeah, and Matt Hardy taking credit for the arson committed at Jeff Hardy's home.
Oh, my God. I didn't even put that one together.
Yeah.
So – and we'll see if we see another Hardys WrestleMania appearance this year. Do you think we will?
I don't.
You don't?
No.
Well,
there's already so much on the show.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, there is a lot. I'm actually surprised it's capped at 6 hours. If they were to announce an added hour to the pre-show, would not surprise me at all.
I'm sure they'll add a post-show of some sort.
Yeah.
They usually do that.
But I don't feel that's – I mean, I feel that's going to be people's breaking point that, okay, I'm done. We got the Law to look forward to now.
That's right.
Which we can announce now. The Law that night of WrestleMania will be on from 11:30, because let's be honest, we know they're going past 11. 11:30 till 2 a.m., not till 2 p.m.
Wow.
So Eastern two time. And a half hour show, and you and I will be on the show as well.
Cool.
That night from Orlando, where at least it's going to be warm in Orlando, because that's going to be a long, long day.
Mm.
Long night.
Yep.
All right. So WrestleMania, as I said, the build wasn't great, but people did buy this show. This was well above expectations of where the buys would be. They did 955,000 buys worldwide, 579 domestic. That was still down from the prior year, which was the Floyd Mayweather match, which did 1,058,000.
A legitimate question. Do you think the fact that it said anniversary on it affected the buy rate at all, added to the buy rate at all?
I'm sure that there were some that it was
– oh, my God. It's not just 24, 20. It's a 25th anniversary. Like if it's a friend's birthday party and it's the 20, you know, like it's sort the guy's sort of your friend, but it's his 30th birthday. Would you feel more pressure to show up?
No, I wouldn't. But I'm sure
you're
that,
just a jerk, though.
No, I'm. You know, people. I remember this time period fairly well. That in the months leading up. Everyone was stating, you know, this has to be a really big WrestleMania because it's the 25th one. And I think that there were hopes at the time of possibly having Austin wrestle a match, Hogan coming back, those were all things that I think people were looking at, that this was treated almost like WrestleMania 20 was, for instance, right. where it was one of those significant numbers that for whatever reason we as a society give so much more importance to yeah. because, oh my God, it's a 5 or a 0 at the end of it.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's a
that's really sad.
Perfect quarter.
Yeah.
But
we could make a phone call if each WrestleMania was a penny.
Yeah, I'm curious, you know.
No, I think that there was something to that,
mm-hmm.
and they made their whole marketing campaign around it.
But still wrong.
Well, I mean, you could have just done this the following year where yeah, that WrestleMania got hurt, too.
That would have been confusing, though. WrestleMania 26, the 25th anniversary.
The Super Bowl just did it for the 50th anniversary.
Oh, really?
For Super Bowl 51.
Oh, okay.
So it's not that tough.
Those fans are smarter, though. Let's be honest. They can count.
They also set a new company gate record of $6.9 million for this, which has since been shattered. And this was at the Reliant Stadium in Houston, Texas, the site of what many people revere as the greatest WrestleMania of all time, WrestleMania 17 in 2001.
The former Astrodome.
The former Astrodome. And the show started off with an opening video package with Vince McMahon doing a voiceover. And we heard from all these different performers talking about and sharing their biggest WrestleMania moments. So you could have inserted Mojo Rawley in here to talk about Zack Ryder
at WrestleMania. That was his biggest WrestleMania moment?
Yeah.
Yeah. I like these.
Yeah, these were all kind of personal. You had Cena, Michaels, Punk, Hunter, MVP. Lots of Hogan moments throughout this. Jeff Hardy talking about WrestleMania 4 in the tournament. Edge picking Hogan and Warrior. Yeah, just a whole array of different moments that they shared.
The first WrestleMania was such a mind-boggling thing.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to WrestleMania.
Hulk Hogan versus Andre the Giant, WrestleMania 3.
The irresistible force meeting the immovable object.
Everybody that lived and breathed was a Hulk Hogan fan.
Look at this.
I rooted for Andre the Giant.
WrestleMania 4. When Macho Man became the World Heavyweight Champion.
Going to WrestleMania 6 and seeing Hulk Hogan and the Ultimate Warrior and feeling the electricity that was in that building that day.
Shawn Michaels versus Razor Ramon.
That ladder match was just so innovative.
This for the first time ever at a WrestleMania ladder match.
No.
Oh.
Bret versus Owen. Every single WrestleMania that I've been in.
Rock and Hogan. Two icons facing each other.
I think it all Stone Cold's great matches.
The Austin era has begun!
Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart Iron Man match.
WrestleMania 12, the first WWE Championship.
The boyhood dream has come true for Shawn Michaels!
It shows you who the real fans are on the roster. You know, you can kind of see which ones grew up watching wrestling and which ones kind of started a little bit later, maybe more into adulthood. So I'd love for them to do these again. Sean at one point says that WrestleMania is about creating a memory. And I feel like that's something we've heard, you know, that's sort of the booking philosophy of Vince McMahon and the WWE. So you can understand why they would book matches like a Shane versus Taker in favor of maybe a more technical great matchup. It's because of these memories. It's the man falling off of a cage.
I promise you, if they had called up Shinsuke Nakamura and he came out and gave the Kinshasa to AJ Styles and they got 25 minutes,
I wouldn't remember.
I'd have a memory burned in my memory. A memory burned in my memory.
What?
Well, that's what I said. It really doesn't make sense. But I feel they could create a memory. That would be my guess. But no, you're
maybe,
right.
Maybe.
Listen, they have their philosophy for booking WrestleMania. And this is a good indication of it as well on this show. It ended with The Undertaker saying, WrestleMania, and rolling his eyes into the back of his head. Which, if you were not a wrestling fan or understood this character... I don't know if you take this as an endorsement of WrestleMania or him mocking this event.
Huh. I don't know.
You got to watch this from a different set of eyes.
It can't be good for your eyes, can it, to do that your whole life?
Some of my friends would try this when they were kids, and I never did. I thought, that's really dumb. Because someone once told me that, like, if you rolled your eyes in the back of your head and someone hit you, your eyes would stay like that. And that scared
wow.
me.
Wow. I think you had some really awful friends.
Some were mean. Some were.
Oh, boy. Yeah. I don't know if that's true.
I don't think it is true.
Feels kind of good, though. It's like almost like a stretch.
You can do it pretty well. You're scaring me. If I turned around and saw you like that, I'd be scared.
Imagine if I just walked in one day and just like started walking around with my eyes rolled in the back of my head. Oh, that's great.
You could get like those contact lenses and just frighten everybody. Those things are supposed to be bad for you, aren't they?
Yeah, I don't know.
Jeff Hardy needs to stop. I also, in this opening video, it never gets old for me, CM Punk as cheery, happy, babyface CM Punk.
Right.
Like, it just feels so weird to watch.
Yeah.
Where this guy's talking about his memories of WrestleMania.
Yeah, who does he remind you of now on the roster?
Like, who...
Who has that same character right now?
That you think is...
That's
not
that,
as,
that is like CM Punk back then. You know, just kind of vanilla rookie, you know, like, I'm so grateful and happy to be here. Yeah, let's do it.
Mojo Rawley.
Okay, a more subdued Mojo Rawley.
Apollo Crews.
Yes.
He'll be miserable one day.
Yeah.
When he does MMA.
Oh, imagine a pipe bomb from Apollo Crews in like 5 years. It's going to be great.
Wow, that would be great. This company's had me in cruise control since day one, and it's time to go into the next gear.
Yeah. Houston, we have a problem.
I think there was a sign that said that in this.
It's Apollo.
Yeah, yeah.
You got it?
You just tied in Apollo to this WrestleMania.
Yeah, okay.
So, Howard Finkel welcomes everyone to the 25th anniversary. And then we have Nicole Scherzinger. Scherzinger?
I think so, yeah.
Of the Pussycat Dolls.
Yep.
To sing America the Beautiful.
Yeah, the Beyonce of the group. Really the only member of the group. Everyone else was interchangeable.
Has she really Beyonce'd it up since 2009?
No.
I can't even pronounce her name.
Listen,
so.
No one can match the Queen Bee, okay? But I think this girl like hosted some show or something. Like she was a guest judge on some shit.
Yeah, she was. Some talent show. Then they go into a pyro display. They open up the show, and Jim Ross welcomes us to, quote, the wonderment of the 25th anniversary of WrestleMania, which I was wondering about. It was a three-man booth for this show because, as we had said on the last show, the SmackDown going into this was Taz's last show. His contract was up March 31st, right after the SmackDown tapings, and he had reportedly offered to do this show, and – they didn't take him up on that offer. So we got Jerry Lawler and Michael Cole from Raw and Jim Ross from SmackDown. And I kind of enjoyed these three together. In particular, Jim Ross.
I feel like I would have enjoyed these teams as separate duos.
Hmm.
I just felt like – I didn't think they were bad whatsoever. Like it was kind of impressive having two play-by-play guys being able to work together simultaneously. I just didn't think it was necessary, and it just kind of overall made it feel a little disjointed.
Would you have gone with just Ross and Lawler, or?
It's tough because like you need representation from both brands.
Well, Jim Ross was on SmackDown at this
time.
Yeah,
but I mean you also don't want to shut up Michael Cole, who they're trying to groom as the main guy.
Well, that's the reasoning, I feel.
Yeah,
I
guess I just feel like there could have been a better option than simply, oh, we got this guy left over. Let's just match him in. Let's just shove him in there and see what happens. Yeah.
And this would be not Jim Ross's final WrestleMania, but last as a regular. He did the Hell in a Cell match in 2012, but just that match.
Mm-hmm.
So this would be his last WrestleMania that he called as a regular member of the announced team. And then CM Punk, Mark Henry, who was accompanied by Tony Atlas, MVP, Finlay with Hornswoggle, Shelton Benjamin, Kofi Kingston, Christian, and Kane all out for the Money in the Bank ladder match.
Pretty good cross-section of the 2000s mid-card of the WWE.
This was it. MVP, Ross stated, is coming off a 20-match losing streak, which ended with him winning the U.S. title.
Okay.
Which was a perfect summary of the United States title in 2009. The end of the road of a 20-match win streak.
If you lose this many matches, you get the U.S. title.
Maybe that's what Nick Diaz is trying to do.
Just lose matches?
Lose fights. He continually gets title fights, and he's going to get a championship at the end of it. Everyone headed to the floor as Kane and Henry were left inside. Christian and Shelton brought the first ladder in, and they all ganged up to send Kane and Henry to the floor. And then they all fought up the ladder with Kane and Henry returning and turning the ladders over with everyone falling off. Finley hit a suicide dive, Christian with a reverse cross, and then we got stereo suicide dives by Punk and Kofi. Benjamin then climbed up this ladder on the floor and goes for this swanton where I thought this man died. He fell so at such an awkward angle that you just cringed watching this, whether it was live or 8 years later for me. This was a very scary moment, but appeared to be okay. Then Henry climbed. He gets stopped by Finley, nailed him with a shillelagh. Hornswoggle brought a miniature ladder out. Kofi, who was one of the standouts of this, dove through the middle of the ladder inside the ring with a drop kick, and then later hit the Trouble in Paradise to knock Finley off of the ladder. Henry's then holding the ladder in the middle of the ring vertically as Kofi Kingston runs at the ladder and starts climbing it without the ladder set up. He just started climbing straight up and then got sent off by Henry, who then hit a World's Strongest Slam to Kofi onto the ladder. I mean, Kofi was a real standout to me in this match.
I agree. It was his first WrestleMania.
Yes. The ladder was then set up horizontal from the top rope into the main ladder. Benjamin then leaped off of that into an MVP powerbomb. Christian and Punk were fighting on the ladder, and Christian hit an unprettier coming off of it. Then we saw Benjamin scale the ladder, which was angled to the floor. He ran up, then across the horizontal one into the main ladder that was set up in the middle with MVP, and he goes to send him off, and they fell awkwardly. Benjamin then got powerbombed onto Mark Henry on the floor. Shelton had quite a number of big moments in this as well. And then Christian and Benjamin were fighting on the ladders. They got tipped. Benjamin landed on the floor. Christian bounced back up. Crowd very excited here until Punk leaped onto the ladder, fought Christian. Punk was then hanging upside down from his leg. Kane climbed up. Christian falls off. Punk head kicked Kane repeatedly, knocking him down. And there were people that seemed negative towards Punk winning. It seemed like there was a big contingent that wanted to see Christian win this. He had just come back to TV, but Punk grabbed the briefcase, and this was a very surprising finish given that Punk had won this a year ago. And Cole says that Punk always says luck is for losers, which was a line that he continued into his UFC tenure.
No.
And CM Punk, back-to-back winner of the Money in the Bank ladder match. The first year was his babyface cash-in, and this year would eventually lead to the heel turn and his best feud up to that date with Jeff Hardy eventually. Mm-hmm. But what did you think of this opener?
I thought a really good Money in the Bank match. Some excellent spots here. They went really fast throughout the entire thing. It was that type of car crash TLC style.
They didn't have a ton of time here, like 15 minutes. Sure. Like they had a lot to work in.
They did a lot. So it was a lot less based on psychology or slow pacing and a lot more just spot after spot after spot. And I thought they were successful. You know, you see a roster like this and a lineup like this for Money in the Bank, and you know, you might question some of them, like Mark Henry or Kane, but they ended up using everybody's traits effectively with the ladders. You had your high flyers like Kofi and Shelton, who demonstrated stole the show and kind of, you know, kept you remembering their spots out of everybody. Finley had more of the hardcore brawling style using the ladders, and then you had like giants like a Kane and Mark Henry who were great to have as bases.
Yeah, this was a good opener. They recapped Access with fans all over the place coming for this, and our Christian Cage t-shirt from TNA made its way into another video package. Then we were introduced by Lillian Garcia to the one, the only Kid Rock.
Yeah, the fact that he was up second was maybe a little surprising.
I didn't understand why this battle royal was placed here on the show. This could have been something late in the show to break things up. Like this would have been perfect to come out of Shawn and Taker.
Right before Orton and Triple H, maybe.
There definitely needed to be a come down at some point in there instead of being the actual come down was in the main event. So we got all the hits way Ba Wada Ba, Rock and Roll Jesus, Cowboy, All Summer Long, and then into the big hit. So Hot to, because there's two T's.
His new song.
Yes.
Newest single. Yeah, I felt like this went way too long. Kid Rock had, what, like 7 minutes out there?
This was longer
than... You timed that?
Yeah, like this could have been, well...
And this crowd was not reacting to much of what was being played because, again, it's the problem with music and wrestling. Unless it's something connected to wrestling, like if he had played Taker's theme, if he had played maybe that Desire video, that remember that one? The Lonely Road of Faith?
Yeah.
Man,
yeah.
That's the best video they've ever made. You know, if they had played that, if he had played that to that video, God, that'd be awesome.
Man, we're going to need the Kleenex.
Yeah, but instead it was just like, you know, Kid Rock playing a bunch of his, some of them are hits, but not everybody's going to like this shit. So unless you can tie it to wrestling, then I don't think it's really worth doing, in my opinion.
Well, then we got what I can only classify as one of the worst matches in WrestleMania history. And it was just a clusterfuck, the definition of clusterfuck.
Yeah.
The buildup for this was that it would be a 25 Diva Battle Royal, including names from the past. And it was notable at the time that Trish Stratus turned this down. I believe Lita turned this down.
Smart.
Trish basically said that in her, you know, most polite way that she just didn't see the plan and she thought it should be a big deal when she comes back.
Mm-hmm.
And history will be 100% on the side of Trish Stratus, who would have greatly regretted being part of this.
So who were the divas that did make their return? Okay, a little bit, or maybe we should get into it throughout the match because I don't think anybody realized that these girls were even in the match until they were eliminated.
We never had announcements ahead of time. You literally had to be paying attention during the entrances. They didn't even get like identified,
dude. They didn't even get their own song. They're walking out to Kid Rock.
They came out to So Hot.
And there was no camera focused on each of them. They just came out in a bunch all at once.
Could you imagine Tazza calling So Hahatata? This was the epitome of this match, if you want to go back and watch it, is the fact that the first 30 seconds of the match featured Justin Roberts explaining the rules. He's talking over the match on the speakers.
Somebody told him to start probably too fast.
I was glad because I wasn't quite sure how the Battle Royal worked. It's glad we got
this. It's impossible to keep up with the cameraman. The directors couldn't even focus on any individual thing. It was a wide shot the entire time, so you didn't see the faces. They're all faceless bodies, basically.
Layla was gone in seconds.
How did you even know it was Layla?
I had to rewind and pay attention. She was never identified. Yeah. She was just there and gone. They showed Candice Michelle and Mae Young at ringside. Thankfully, they didn't put Mae Young in this match. She was just the timekeeper. Rosa Mendez was out next. Then Jerry Lawler is informed that Sonny's in there. And then Sonny was dumped out.
King of Sonny! Where's Sonny? WWE Divas of all time!
Where is Sonny?
She was eliminated and nobody realized. So if you're Tammy Lynn Sitch, you make your big reappearance at WrestleMania, you sign on to do this thing. You walk out, sure, but you don't get a name key. You don't even get a close-up shot of your face as you're out there. Your elimination isn't even mentioned until the announcer's, I think Sonny's walking around outside.
Unlike the song, Sonny did not come home with a vengeance. Jackie Gator was also one of the women.
She was?
She was back.
I had no clue.
Yep. her and Molly were in there.
Dude, her name was Jackie Gator even mentioned once on
I think they said her name once. I don't know if they ever got around to Molly. The best one. At 2 minutes, a blonde woman is knocked out, and the announcers go, oh, that was Tori Wilson, who had also made a big comeback for this Battle Royal. And this was back at the time, okay? After this battle royal, this atrocity, Kevin Eck, then of the Baltimore Sun, interviewed Tori, who said, I'm very mad at myself and embarrassed that I agreed to be part of something like that. A lot of people in the audience didn't even know that I was in that match because they didn't even announce it. I feel like maybe I'm not appreciated like I would have hoped.
and then goes on to say, I didn't appreciate that experience, and I felt very underappreciated after all of the years that I put in for them. You combine that with the fact that I asked them to do a little thing on WWE.com to vote for me for this reality show she was on, and they just ignored me. So my feelings are hurt.
Yeah.
That was the legacy of this match for Tori's big comeback here for this awful battle royal.
Yeah, I just didn't even see much of the point of this. It's not like you could even get a pop for these hot girls being on TV. You couldn't even see them.
Victoria eliminated Maria. Gail Kim, who had re-signed with the company after leaving TNA for the first time, she was rushed onto TV 2 weeks earlier in order to get into this match, which, listen, I guess you get a WrestleMania payday. That's nice. But from a creative standpoint, God, we got to get this woman on TV so she can be in this forgettable battle.
And how does she get eliminated? She does a Hurricane Rana, and then she eliminates herself until the floor. This is your former TNA main eventer.
Reduced to nothing in record time. Tiffany and Eve Torres were out next. Then Beth eliminated Kelly and Molly. I guess you can say Beth got at least some shine here, getting to do a few eliminations. Victoria bounced off the bottom rope to the floor. The Bellas were sent out. Then we're down to Mickey, Michelle McCool, Beth Phoenix, Melina, and dressed in drag, Santino Marella as Santina. Mickey and McCool crashed off the turnbuckle to the floor. Then Beth and Melina tumble onto the mat from the turnbuckle. Phoenix goes for the glam slam, and Santino eliminates both of them to win the match in 6 minutes and 10 seconds, and then announces she is Santina and is presented with the Miss WrestleMania crown and sash as Beth is furious as Santino dances. Awful. Like, right up there with the worst matches I can recall in WrestleMania history. Like, this would definitely crack the top 5, I would guess.
It was pretty bad.
This was horrible.
It was pretty bad.
The lowest point of this WrestleMania.
And really just a setup for the gag of Santina dancing, which I thought he was really funny doing.
Listen, this guy did – that's all that is remembered for this, and he carried this character on for a few more weeks after this. Like, he's very funny, but it was just so – like, the women could not have
–
if you want to – really juxtapose the women's division today, this would be your evidence to contrast it to of where they were in 2009. Afterthoughts in their own match.
Mm-hmm.
Then we got a video of Chris Jericho's attacks on the Legends, a black and white video with a bloodied Ric Flair where Chris Jericho was fined over, and then stomping on Shawn Michaels' watch that he had given Ric Flair. And then we got a shot of Mickey Rourke in the crowd next to Frank Shamrock a week before his fight with Nick Diaz in Strikeforce.
Oh, wow.
And
was Mickey Rourke always scheduled to at least appear, or was this a last-minute thing?
They ended up working out the deal. I don't know when it was made official that he would at least be there. Of course, the big plan was a match with Jericho, which they didn't go for. And then Mickey Rourke felt that Jericho might actually shoot on him or something and thus brought Frank Shamrock and some other fighters with him for backup.
That's why those guys
were
here?
That's why Frank and them were there.
Are you kidding me?
Jericho goes over all of this in his book and had the great story about the day before or something like that. They're at the venue and Frank Shamrock's off in the distance and Vince is with Jericho talking about like this midget over there that he could take, and Jericho's like, that's Frank Shamrock. Like Vince having no clue who this guy is, and it's the funniest story and a great mindset of Vince McMahon, who just like this guy who just looks at this guy and his size. I'd kill that guy.
I wish Frank could have had a run, man, in the WWE.
There were at times, I think it was an interview I did with him where there were at least feelers from ECW at the time. Yeah, I really feel this guy could have definitely transitioned, like certainly had the promos that could have done very well. Like, you know, if he had been, I think, of more higher fame, like imagine if he had been the Mickey Rourke figure. I mean, that would have been a cool program.
Has he done wrestling?
I mean, he did Pancrase, but I mean, that was.
But he didn't grow up like a Ken training and pro.
No, he.
I don't know if he's actually done pro wrestling. I don't think he has. Mm. I mean, he did Pancras matches, which, I mean, some may or may not have been works that he was aware of or not.
Yep.
But I don't think he actually did pro wrestling like Ken did. So Chris Jericho against Ricky Steamboat, The Superfly, Jimmy Snuka, and Roddy Piper is our 3-on-1 match, which with Ric Flair in the corner of the three legends, and Roddy Piper wore a t-shirt, and clearly me and Roddy Piper thought alike, and Roddy Piper was aware of this awful anniversary, this misleading slogan. So on the back of his shirt, it read, "Old School's Cool, WrestleMania 0-25. So he made a WrestleMania 0 for his shirt.
Oh, 0-25.
So he
is that what that meant?
Well, he said WrestleMania 0-25. That means he's acknowledging a WrestleMania 0 that never existed just to make the anniversary make sense.
That's weird.
Maybe I'm reading too much into this shirt.
Yeah, you could be. It's also a weird thing to put on a shirt, 0-25. Does he mean he's...
Well, it means he was...
0-25?
I think...
0 wins, 25 losses.
Well, he doesn't have 0 wins at WrestleMania. He would have had...
Well, let's see this.
He lost a tag match at the first one. He had like...
Well, he's not been in 25 WrestleManias.
No, he hasn't. But I'm trying to think if he's had...
Has he ever won at WrestleMania?
Well, I'm going through them now. He beat Goldust at the back brawl.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He had the Mr. T thing, which was like a DQ loss. He beat Adrian Adonis at the third one, was gone for 4, did a speaking segment at 5, faced Bad News Allen at 6, lost to Brett at 8, then Goldust, and I think that was his last WrestleMania, I believe. And then this one. So, I mean, he hasn't had a stellar track record, but he's at least won some.
Okay. So, very, very impressive, that recall.
Well, that's what I'm here for, Way. Piper attacks Jericho at the beginning, and Jim Ross immediately says that offensively, this match will be bowling shoe ugly for the legends. Not even going to go out on a limb and wait and see.
Yeah, at least 2 of the 3 he was right about.
Yes, yes, very true. And I think everyone knew that. And again, going over this, one of the original ideas was it would be Greg Valentine in the Steamboat role. And because Vince McMahon was adamant that all three legends needed to be on that first WrestleMania card for whatever reason. And thus Jerry Lawler wasn't eligible. And then they realized Ricky Steamboat was on the first WrestleMania card and was working there for the company. And
he's going in the Hall of Fame.
Going in the Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. And then there was a thing about what, because he had gone through a divorce, and it was, does he even own the rights to the name Ricky Steamboat? Because that was part of his divorce, and he did have the rights to it. So they were able to use him.
Yeah. If he didn't.
Never lose your work name way in a divorce.
If he didn't have the rights, though, he'd be Richard Blood.
One of the greatest.
Dude.
Natural names that, like, someone said, hey, we want to have this loose connection to Sammy Steamboat, so we're going to rename you from Richard Blood.
Dude, what better name is there than Dick Blood? Dick
How
Blood.
I never heard that joke in my life.
Wow, what a
God.
The career this man could have had in multiple avenues.
Oh, God. He could have, yeah.
That's a great band name. He should be a musician, the new Kid Rock.
Dude, the Richard Bloods would be a great like punk band.
Yeah, would be.
And their title track could be Dick Blood.
Okay.
Yeah. Blow Fire.
It's maybe they could open up for Fucked Up.
Man.
Dick Blood.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
So they went over the top to the floor, and Roddy Piper tried a drop kick, and I'm using the word tried. Like, God bless the guy at his age and with hip replacement surgery, tried a drop kick.
It kind of ended up looking like an enziguri to the forearm.
Did he get that high?
I don't know. Well, you got one leg up there.
There was a lot of drop and not a lot of kick. So then Jericho's just selling here. Steamboat comes in with an overhand chop off the top and then the deep arm drag. And, I mean, there was not even a question of – who was the star of the legends.
No.
When he hit this deep arm drag, Jim Ross, he was transported back to 1989. I mean, he had just the chills he was saying watching this.
When was the last time Steamboat would have wrestled on TV?
94.
I mean, he retired with a back injury. Was it just Jim Ross? I imagine the world was a little taken aback, you know, to see this picture-perfect arm drag from Ricky Steamboat at this age.
Yeah. I mean, this to me, I'm trying to think of like what would be an equivalent. I mean, the arm drag was just so associated with Ricky Steamboat. And I mean, this guy, you could tell, really took this seriously and did not want to just go out there for a pop. It was having a semblance of a good match here, and he was the highlight to me. It's all Jericho selling for him. He then takes out Snuka's legs, applies the walls. He eliminates Snuka. So it was elimination rules here with the three.
And Snuka didn't really do all that much. A few chops here and there. In and out.
Then an eye poke by Piper. He applied a sleeper. Jericho just hit him with an enziguri, and he eliminated Piper. So then it came down to Jericho and Steamboat, which I would imagine ranked pretty high among Chris Jericho's moments. Like, this is a guy that was such a big fan of his, and they told the story on TV with the promo where he went to an autograph signing to meet Ricky Steamboat as a fan.
Where Ricky Steamboat had his eyes half closed, that photo.
Yes. Remember that? Yeah, which is in his book.
Wasn't that his favorite? Like, wasn't that one of his favorite matches, or his favorite match was Savage Steamboat, WrestleMania 3?
I would imagine so. Yeah, I don't know. But yeah, for a lot of people, I'm sure would cite that. Steamboat dove off the top with a cross body for a two count. And then Jericho sends Steamboat over the top, and he skins the cat. And then Jericho knocks down Flair, gets back body dropped to the floor. And then Steamboat hits a pescado to the floor. I mean, just very cool to watch.
Yeah.
And then there was a chop off the top, and out of the corner – Steamboat gets an O'Connor roll for his one near fall. Jericho missed a lion salt. Steamboat did a power slam, and then Jericho went for the walls. It was countered into a small package, so there was another near fall. And then Jericho finally hit the code breaker and won in 8 minutes and 58 seconds. I thought the last like 4 or 5 minutes with Steamboat and Jericho was just really cool to watch. And they ended up having, you know, Steamboat would work the following night on Raw, and then these two would have a singles match at Backlash, and I think they also did some live events together. And those matches were better than this. So this was nostalgia that felt satisfying and not, you know, because some of these matches, when you bring back legends, it can be kind of depressing at times when they can't, especially a Steamboat, who you remember for his in-ring. And yeah, he was older, he was bigger, but by no means embarrassed himself.
No, he was... He made the match.
It was.
Imagine if it was Greg Valentine or somebody else less physically capable. The match certainly started off really ugly, but the shock and surprise of Steamboat looking so good, especially when you had the other two lower your expectations so much, I thought really made this into a special, dare I say it, WrestleMania moment.
Yes, it really was. Maybe you could safely say Steamboat's second best match in WrestleMania history.
Hmm.
With all due respect to his opener against Butch Reed in 1988.
Sure.
This was – I don't see how you could be too disappointed with this given Steamboat.
Yep.
Now, afterwards, it was all the back stuff with Flair, who, of course, they were not going to put into a match after the retirement. He charges the ring. Jericho attacks him. Flair's delivering chops. Jericho hits him with a back body drop and a code breaker, and then gets onto the microphone, says he eliminated the washed out legends, and starts addressing Mickey Rourke and challenges him and asks if he's a coward. And they show Mickey Rourke with his buddies, and they've got this big screen in front of them in the crowd. You're in the front row and you need a big screen in front of you? Holy Christ.
Maybe it was obstructed view with the post. Ring post.
Yeah, that could have been it. So anyway, Rourke, just ever the worker. He just milks every movement.
Oh, yeah. He was very good, actually.
So this guy, who's actually done some boxing, comes in. He throws a double jab with his left hand and then catches Jericho with a left hook, which I want to know way – what you thought of his technique with the left hook.
Fuck, he could probably teach me. I wouldn't know.
Well, then you could teach me. What did you think of his hips?
I thought he looked great. Shane McMahon could definitely take some lessons.
Well, Rourke probably landed with all the same as a Shane punch did here. It looked like he knocked Jericho right in the face here. I think it was just left to just throw.
Didn't he leave like fight acting to compete in boxing several years? So the guy definitely knows what he's doing.
Did a fight not too many years ago.
Yeah, well, fight.
Yeah, there was certainly some.
Might have been his second pro wrestling match just did. But he looked very solid, very convincing.
Yeah, so this was kind of like you couldn't do the match, so it was just a spot with Jericho kind of left laying here. Yeah. I mean, they put a lot of time and effort into this thing with Mickey Rourke. I didn't think it was like the biggest payoff in the world
can also argue whether or not it was detrimental to have a full-time guy
definitely
be knocked out by an actor.
Yeah, it's like once the Academy Awards were over, it's like the wrestler stuff, I mean, it was still – people were aware of the movie, but – I mean, Mickey Rourke was kind of – this was the end of his kind of his wrestling fame too.
But they're also just looking for something that the tabloids would pick up, right?
Then we got a video on the Hardys feud and Matt's turn on Jeff at the Royal Rumble to lead to their Extreme Rules match. And I don't know about you, but it was kind of jarring to watch this version of Matt Hardy. After the last year,
I didn't like this version of Matt Hardy at all.
He was very bland.
Yeah, he's just kind of like the Matt Hardy I saw at WrestleMania 25 just kind of looked like an older, fatter version of the Matt Hardy that I think we all knew back in the TLC era. Whereas the Matt Hardy of 2017 is still the same size, but he feels like a completely different person. So, and he feels just awesome.
Now, if the WWE were to bring the Hardys back, I think everyone agrees, like you need them in that gimmick. Is there an argument at least to bring them back as these Hardys for the initial nostalgia and the merchandise that goes with the Hardys, and then on your own, you morph them into the characters on your television with a story in place, and then you get a second run of merchandise and with these characters having more room? Or should they, if they were to go to WWE, instantly show up as the broken characters?
There's an argument for it, certainly, especially considering merchandise. However, I feel like today your audience and the WWE are an audience that's so tuned to what's going on the internet. A large portion of them have probably already seen Broken Matt Hardy in his current incarnation. So I don't know
if they
would buy it.
Even if they come out as the old Hardys,
there'd be a ton of delete chance
all over.
Yeah. And, you know, why not just start it hot? Yeah. Bring in all the stuff.
So this is Matt also in tights.
Yeah.
Which is kind of weird. Usually you're used to him in those baggy pants.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim Ross says there is no rock act that has ever played Reliant Stadium that received a bigger reaction than Jeff did. And I took this as Jim Ross, not a Kid Rock fan.
No.
Man.
Wow.
So then we got this awkward exchange as Jim Ross and Lawler are talking about the dog of Jeff's that was killed.
But when Matt Hardy admitted to setting a fire which cost Jeff's dog Jack its life.
Now, wait a minute. Matt never admitted that.
Well, he gave enough indication.
Well, he didn't admit it.
Yeah, he didn't. He wasn't man enough to admit it. Well, the bottom line is this. You have to understand what Jack, that dog meant to Jeff Hardy. That dog was Jeff's rock.
That could have been an accident.
Yeah, it must have been an accident that Matt committed this murder of a pet, even though that was the basis of this feud, was that these were not accidents.
Hmm.
So I don't know if they were trying to maybe take a step back from our animal cruelty idea. Jeff hit Matt over the head with this poster and then a poetry in motion off the steel steps into Matt against the barricade. And we got like this, you know, you got to imagine these two spent a ton of time thinking like this is a WrestleMania match between these two. They're going to go all out and try and have the greatest match possible. And they went out and they did like this hardcore match. And I don't feel they ever really had the crowd at the level they were probably anticipating.
Mm-hmm.
They had 13 minutes out here.
And they did a lot of stuff.
They did a lot. And I don't know if it was too much or if it was too close to the ladder match that they had just seen, that it felt maybe like overkill, but they never Like this crowd, it was not just, hey, they're in a stadium, it's quieter. Like we heard the crowd louder later in the show. Yeah. And this was one where it's just like they were going all out. And I think it was just a combination of things, not the least of which this was a feud no one bought.
Yeah, I think it's all those things. For me personally, watching this match now, I feel like I'm just kind of tired of the style, that car crash style, especially after seeing it. You can arguably say executed better in the TLC match, you know, with more variety. But, you know, the Hardys doing it here, these two are great at this style of match, but I'm at the point now where, like, I hate to see guys actually get hurt, you know, actually get, like, hit in the head with, like, objects.
Vacuums.
Yeah, vacuums.
A vacuum was used here.
Yeah, and just, like, there, you can argue, like, when, that there's, like, the TLC matches had some great creative spots. They tried here, but, like, there are just some that didn't make sense. Like, at one point, Jeff sets up a table, puts Matt on top, then puts a chair on top of Matt, and then he stacks another table on top of all that.
And then splashes through the one table to put Matt through the second table with the chair in there.
Well, what the fuck is the point of the chair? And like, it's just too much. It's like a fucking video game, you know? And it's just not very believable at that point. So maybe less is more.
Yeah,
the
finish came when Jeff pulled out two ladders, set them both up in the ring, and then just hopped over the one to the other, missing a leg drop. And then Matt just hit a twist of fate with Jeff's neck inside of a chair, and Matt pinned him. So I don't feel
that leg
drop. Here was the guy who like admitted to trying to kill Jeff, who did kill his dog, and in the end, Matt's triumphant here. Like it was just. Yeah, I think there was a lot going wrong for this, and the people were just not into this feud. I mean, this was a – like we talk about the Wyatt feud being out there. This was one – there was no semblance of reality or believability here.
It's and funny because they're doing characters that are completely out there now, but you're fully going in that direction. And it's, you know, like if you're going to devote yourself to being completely ridiculous, then go completely ridiculous.
Well, this story, though, it was not just ridiculous. It was also pretty tasteless because people knew Jeff really did lose his dog in a fire. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was a real thing that happened. And it just felt really – it just felt really cheap to go that direction for a feud that nobody bought between two brothers.
Mm.
So this was the latest Hardy feud that – faltered in the WWE. And let's be honest, TNA did the best version of the Hardys ever feuding and then got something out of it where they were renewed characters. And I mean, credit goes to them too.
It goes to the Hardys for having the creative control. But I mean, you can maybe at this time in the WWE, they didn't necessarily have that creative.
Then Randy Orton is in the locker room with Legacy. There were no words here. We just got a deep look into Randy's eyes. And then JBL comes out with the IC title.
Oh, no. The cookie.
Oh. Birthday's ruined.
It's still good. JBL's out, and he calls it the greatest day in his life. And he runs down the little men here in Houston that drink lattes and do Pilates and are looking for work. And yet JBL is still their hero. He's going to win tonight and then return to New York City, and he'll still be their hero. Rey Mysterio comes out. He had missed the last two WrestleManias due to injury.
Mm.
So before Seth Rollins was teasing it, this guy was living it. So he comes back, and he's dressed as the Joker.
Yeah, he's in his Heath Ledger Joker getup, which I don't know about this one.
Because Heath Ledger had already died or
no,
just because of the costume? Because
I thought it looked really bad.
Oh, okay. Well, maybe not one of his best then. JBL delivers a big boot as the referee is going over the instructions and attacks Ray in the corner before the bell even rings. Ray responds with an enziguri and then a 619 and splashes him off the top, and Ray Mysterio wins in the same amount of time it took Bill Goldberg to win the Universal title. 21 seconds.
21 seconds.
Yeah.
You know, at the pace of that this show was going and how long the next match was going to be.
This year's WrestleMania needs a match like this.
Oh, I have no complaints about a 21-second match. You know, like sometimes they did this also with Brian Sheamus that one year.
Yes.
And
was a year that that would – well, you know what? In hindsight, that ended up being the best thing for Brian. bad for that night in that crowd.
You could have gotten there with, in other ways, though. He would have been screwed some other way.
I think people did view that, though, as like it got him.
It's one of many things.
I think he looks back. I don't think he would change that as much as you would.
I don't know. Because
remember what Raw was like the next night?
Fine.
They treated him like the guy who got fucked at WrestleMania.
They would have treated him that way anyway for some other injustice he would have probably suffered at some point. But for me, like being there for that WrestleMania, I just kind of felt robbed of a Daniel Bryan match that I really wanted to see. And granted, there might have been Rey Mysterio fans here that really wanted to see Rey put on a great 20-minute match. I just felt like this instance worked better than the Bryan Sheamus one because you had a great, dominant, physically larger heel in JBL taunting and the underdog. Whereas like in the other one, Bryan was the heel. And to have the babyface beat him in 21 seconds or have a larger baby – to have a larger, more physically intimidating babyface beat him in 21 seconds, I didn't feel like worked as well.
Really didn't combine the two of – how similar Goldberg Owens was to Sheamus and Bryan. Like, they're very similar in that the guy that they were all in with, pushing towards. I mean, Sheamus and Goldberg a bit different because one was, you know, he was a guy that they were building as a full-time performer. But someone that, I mean, the audience very much respects Bryan, respects Owens.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, certainly there's been some backlash to Goldberg, but nothing like
it was
Sheamus,
Sheamus
and Bryan.
Yeah.
But similarities nonetheless. And this was JBL's retirement match. He was done after this. His back was just wrecked. He sat in the ring afterwards and announces that he quits as the fans cheer and yells at the audience on his way up the ramp. And, you know, it was kind of
a good way to go out.
Put this guy over like super, super hard and
have your last match at WrestleMania. Come on. It's
yeah.
Great.
Yeah. This
it was cool seeing, JBL really took his time to walk out afterwards and his face, like looking at him as the crowd was chanting, na, 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 hey, hey, hey. His face looked like a combination of like really trying to soak in the moment of, you know, walking out as a performer for the last time while also trying to maintain an angry heel persona.
Yeah, so this was it for JBL, who, yeah, he was going through all these injuries at this time and just, admittedly, like just trying to get through at this time match wise.
Mm-hmm.
We saw NASCAR driver Carl Edwards in the crowd. And then we go into the feature for Shawn Michaels and The Undertaker. And it's just going through all of Taker's opponents at Mania, the various calls from his victories, and then Michaels' big Mania moments. And how the darkness represents the Undertaker, the lightness for Michaels, and we contrast that to death and life. I don't know about you. I thought this package was just fantastic. This felt good. Like the main event of the show, watching this video package. And in hindsight, probably should have been that year, which they did learn the next year and put it on last.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had a choir way as Shawn Michaels descended from heaven, all in white, and then into pyro as his theme began. And Ross notes this is Michael's 16th WrestleMania, while The Undertaker is 16-0 at WrestleMania.
Very cool entrance.
And that was just half of it, because then we had Taker rising from the death underneath. And this was just something that I probably didn't appreciate at the time, just how – this is a very basic story, but – you don't get a whole lot of that in pro wrestling.
And the entrances on the show, some of these two, the one Cena had, I thought were all great. We're all really impressive. World class.
So Shawn and The Undertaker, as I texted you on the weekend way, this was a good match. It's very good.
You were right.
Yep.
Who would have known?
Yep. So Michaels fakes a knee injury early and then jumps Taker. Taker is hitting him with strikes. Hits the old school, but then misses a running boot in the corner, which I just, man, some of these guys that miss those running boots in the corner, I just cringe. Like Braun Strowman did it a few weeks ago, and I'm watching Taker here. You just think of this guy tearing something.
That's why you stretch.
Yeah, that's, I guess, why. Michaels attacks the left knee and applies a figure four, albeit not a great one.
It's his modified figure four / sharpshooter type of thing.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
Taker comes out, hits a snake eyes and then a running boot and leg drop for the first cover of the match, getting a two count. And then Michaels blocked a choke slam and applied a cross face and gets out of that. Taker avoided a super kick and then went for Hell's Gate, which got such an enormous reaction. Mm-hmm. Like when you go back, when he started that submission, no one reacted to it. Yeah. And they built it, and then it ended up being the closing spot of the Edge match in the main event the prior year.
Same with Hunter.
And now Hunter the tease, match. Just the tease for it.
Yeah.
And people are going nuts. Like, that's how you get a submission over, was this Gogo Plata that The Undertaker introduced. And this crowd, they just reacted like, man, he gets that. Michaels is fucked.
Mm.
It was incredible.
Yeah.
Anyway, Michaels got to the rope. Then Taker missed a leg drop onto the edge of the apron, and Michaels misses a moonsault off the top and just crashes onto the floor. Holy Christ. This was like a guy doing a belly flop into a pool, except it was Matt's. He just, like, plopped onto this floor. So Taker then, he sidesteps that. Michaels is down. The ref is checking on him. Taker then returns to the ring. And he sets up for a tope. And Shawn Michaels grabs the stunt cameraman, the other snooka on this card.
Sim
snooka. And pulls him in front as Taker angles and angles. And his head comes crashing down for what had to be one of the most frightening moments that I will never forget. And watching this live, I thought I had just watched The Undertaker. Like, this was whatever the Shelton spot was earlier, this was 100 times scarier. And I thought when this happened, I thought this dude was paralyzed. Yeah. This was – even watching it back, I was cringing watching this.
How could you not?
Oh, my God. How – they showed the replay, and it's like I'm watching with one eye open here. And it looks like he turned his head almost too much that it might have actually helped his landing. That instead of just crashing so his neck snapped back, it was like he almost kind of tucked at the end. Still a bad landing. I don't know how he survived this. I was trying to figure it out and watching this.
I feel like a lot of people have since like put the blame on Sim Snuka. I don't know if I would necessarily put
all the
blame on
him. Taker came down at an awful angle.
Yeah.
Like, it would have been really hard to – listen, I'm not a worker. But to catch him at that angle and the size of that guy with a camera in his hand.
With a camera in his hand.
It was an awful idea. It was an awful idea.
Taker had a very short trajectory. I mean, it's not an awful idea. The guy's done in every match prior to this.
If you were if you were banking, though, on a guy catching you and you want him to have a fucking camera – like, next time you're shooting, I'll try this and we'll see how well you can catch me. I think it'd be hard.
But it just seemed like the guy was kind of out of position. Shawn was maybe a little out of position. Who knows? I don't know who they specifically blamed, but I'm sure maybe Sim Snuka has taken a lot of heat for this in the years since.
Well, I mean, for things like this, Sim Snuka probably becomes the fall guy in all this. And it's like, I'm not going to assign blame for this. I mean, it was unfortunate, and thankfully, this guy was okay. But then, I mean, this is kind of the perverse beauty of pro wrestling, is that things that happen that suddenly take you into this.
Oh, and now it feels real.
It's real.
Yeah.
And you really believe that this guy is messed up.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm watching this and Taker's lying there. Shawn is clearly stalling with the referee, Marty Elias. And then they're in the ring and Marty just starts counting. And you're thinking, like, is this guy okay? Is he going to make it into the ring, or is this going to be the finish? Like, you don't know what's going on.
And Shawn is cheering on, like wanting for Taker to be counted out, because all he wants is to beat Taker, even if it's by count out.
The crowd just comes alive
as
Taker battles back and gets in at the count of 9. This was a level of drama you get very rarely in matches.
Maybe it was all intentional.
Yes, and this was a hell of an argument for the 20 count in WWE for this poor guy to try and recover.
You just do a slow 10 count.
So Taker gets back in. He avoids a super kick and choke slams Michaels for what was such a better near fall, because I guarantee you 85% of the audience assume that this guy was hurt and they're just going home now.
Yep.
And just finishing the match. And I think tons of people bought this as probably just – you're just cutting to the finish now.
Yeah.
And instead, Michaels kicks out. And Michael stops another choke slam. He hits Sweet Chin Music, and Taker kicks out to a gigantic reaction. Michaels then kips up. He's booed. The Last Ride gets countered. Taker stops a sunset flip and hoists him again for the Last Ride, and Michaels kicks out. This crowd is going insane.
Oh, I really miss the days when this streak was still alive, because all these near falls felt so much more exciting.
That was the goal of every Taker match at this point, was that one near fall, and then you bought the idea that maybe Taker's going to lose.
Yeah.
And then once you had them, the next 7-8 minutes was just you couldn't do any wrong, because you had that believability factor. And every year, everyone said it's so predictable, Taker's going to win. And every year, there was that one near fall where they hooked everyone and you got them for that 8 minutes of magic where you're teasing that maybe this is the year he loses. Jim Ross is asking, how in the name of all that is decent did Michaels kick out? And Taker missed with a top rope elbow drop. Michaels gets thrown over and goes to skin the cat. He goes into Taker, who grabs him into a tombstone, and Michaels kicks out of the tombstone. And Taker just had this incredible look of shock on his face that Michaels survived the tombstone. And Ross yells that he just had an out-of-body experience. This guy was on fire in this match. This was incredible, Jim Ross. The straps come down for Taker. He lifts up Michaels for another tombstone, and Michaels counters that into a DDT. He crawls to the top, lands an elbow onto Taker, and he calls for the Sweet Chin Music. He lands it. Taker kicks out as Ross proclaims this a classic. They go back to the punching and chop exchange, which is how the match began. Michaels goes to the top. A moonsault is caught, and Taker hits a second tombstone, this time pinning Michaels at 30 minutes and 42 seconds as both just lay dead on the mat after this match. And Ross just says he was honored to sit ringside for this. The graphic for 17-0 appears, and Michael Cole says that sometimes it's hell getting into heaven. And Ross ends it by saying he believes we have just seen heaven.
Wow.
I'm tired just recapping this way.
Very good recap. And a great match.
Yes.
Pretty good match.
This was really incredible.
Yeah.
Certainly a match that holds up 8 years later, and one of the best matches in WWE history, I think it's safe to say.
Yeah. I feel like it's, you know, arguments about whether or not this is a 5-star match or if this match is better than this other amazing match, they're all kind of subjective. Certainly if you – I think it takes some some context about the characters and some knowledge of the characters in order to really appreciate the match. If you're just kind of watching the match without – knowing about the stature of these two, it might not be as captivating to you. Or if you're watching after only watching ROH, for instance, where everybody kicks out of every finisher, this might not be that special to you either. But it's a combination of all these things, the fact that it's at WrestleMania. And if you just simply judge this by the crowd reaction of however many people were there, hard to argue how incredible this match was. Tremendous heat. I thought, in my opinion, a great lesson in pacing and milking of spots, something that, you know, certainly felt missing from many of the earlier matches in the evening, where it felt like guys had to really work hard to just cram a lot in. I think it's really cool that you can be in your mid-40s in pro wrestling and still have the performance of your career. Unlike, you know, in many athletics, where you kind of peak early on. And I guess that's because wrestling requires a greater reliance on psychology than just pure athletics. And because it's cooperative, you can kind of work towards your limitations. And I think we saw the best instance of that in this match.
And one quote I just wanted to share here. Chad from the Two-Man Power Trip of Wrestling podcast sent this over to us. And they had Marty Elias on after this, and he was talking about the match. And they brought up the fact that this wasn't the main event on the show. And Marty Elias goes on to say that it wasn't the main event. And he says that that match was actually only supposed to be 15 minutes. And they were originally supposed to be third on the card for that show. He goes on to say, I remember being told that and us sitting in there. It was me, Shawn Michaels, Undertaker, Pat Patterson, and Michael Hayes. And when Michael Hayes told Shawn and Taker that we're third and we only had 15 minutes, it was something that needed to be changed. Now, it did change and we didn't get the main event, but it was something that we just kind of looked at each other, and Shawn and Taker looked at each other and gave these puzzled looks. And I still remember that. And when you said it wasn't the main event, it brought back a bunch of memories. And that's why I'm laughing about about it. It should have been the main event. And one of the things I will say is that after that match, Sean and I came through the curtain and we walked through and everybody is clapping. Everyone was giving it a standing ovation and Hurricane Helms was standing right there. And I'll never forget what he said. He said something to the effect of, "Oh my God, if there is a mercy rule in pro wrestling right now, they might as well pull the mercy rule because no one is going to follow that." And they were the main event the following year. But can you, like, from start to finish, from entrance, the first entrance to the final scene, 45 minutes was blocked out for this.
Wow.
Could you imagine if they had, even if you're not including entrances, 15 minutes of this match instead of 30? This is a much different match.
Yep. 100%.
I couldn't imagine that this was like it, when you're skimming stuff for time, like you, it's amazing to look back at what this may have been if they had only gotten 15.
So what do you think was actually changed in order for these guys to get their time? Obviously, probably JBL and Ray.
I would imagine that might have been cut to be super quick.
Maybe the Divas entrances, perhaps.
That may have been, the Hardys. Their time felt about right.
Yeah.
The ladder match maybe trimmed a bit. I don't know.
Maybe.
So anyway.
The main event.
Certainly wasn't the final match.
Yeah.
I don't think so. That one wasn't getting touched. So
who had to follow this match?
Well, other than a shot of Evander Holyfield and Cole saying he hopes that we're not too exhausted because the world championship match is next as we go into our video package. Our three-way title match had to follow this. And this is where the Battle Royal should have been, in my opinion.
I would argue that the Battle Royal should have been after this one. Because
maybe
this match wasn't bad. This was actually quite good.
No, maybe you're right. This video package, Cena summarized this entire storyline for me. Quote, "I feel I'm on the outside of a love triangle looking in to the once coveted world championship." That was a nice description. So Chavo Guerrero wheels out Vicky before the match, and then we got our entrances for Edge, for Big Show, and then the big entrance reserved for John Cena as the Cena stunt doubles came out to his old rap theme, followed by the originator, John Cena.
Dude, there must have been like 80 Cenas here.
This was a hell of a casting call.
And it was a lot of jorts. The most jorts I'd ever seen in my life. I'm talking like 80 pairs of jorts. Probably like they cleared like JCPenney, I bet.
So, this is probably one of those visuals of a John Cena entrance you remember. I mean, this is one of those entrances you certainly would remember.
I thought it was really nice.
So Cena's out and all of the guys, like all 2,000 of these John Cenas do the "you can't see me" hand sign, which,
and they had a Steadicam run with John Cena through the row of Cenas.
Ross and Cole are talking about how Big Show is up to 485 pounds, which made it all the more entertaining when Big Show came out and Lillian announced him at 441. The Big Show turns down an offer early to work with Edge and crotches him on the top rope. Edge then drop kicks the steps into the knees of Big Show, and Cena comes off the turnbuckle with a leg drop to Big Show on the floor. Chavo then pulls Cena to the floor and takes an AA. There was a shoulder block, and then Big Show got his arms tied into the ropes, which is the Andre spot. Vicky then got up from her wheelchair onto the apron. Cena sidesteps, and Edge spears Vicky off the apron, allowing Cena to then do a roll-up for a two count with Big Show's arms still tied into the ropes. Show then gets free and hits a double choke slam. But only manages to hit Edge with it and then knocks out Cena with a punch. And Edge then leaps off the steps on the floor, sending Big Show through the barricade. Edge comes back. He goes for a spear into an STF, gets pulled away from the ropes. Big Show's in. He misses a Vader bomb to Edge. Cena and Edge then do a double team vertical suplex when Edge then sucker kicks Cena. Show then shoves Cena off the turnbuckle into an Edge spear. And then Edge is going for a sleeper. Cena comes. He lifts both of them up for a double AA, but Edge pops off. The AA is hit to Big Show. Then he hits one to Edge on top of Big Show, and Cena gets the pin on Big Show. 14 minutes, 44 seconds, and John Cena wins the title.
Yeah, considering the terrible spot these guys had having to follow one of the best matches of all time in the WWE, I thought these three did really well. And I thought overall it was a pretty good match. to me, the big story of the match was whether or not Cena could AA the Big Show. And they teased it earlier on. He was unsuccessful. The finish was a little odd because I don't know if Cena was actually supposed to AA both of them at once. But, you know, I felt like they should have had a solo standoff between Big Show and Cena. And Cena AAing the Big Show should have been the finish. Here, he actually did it, but it seemed kind of lost and everything, and he ultimately ended up delivering it to Edge to win.
If I was Edge, though, I probably don't want to be taking a double AA with
the Big Show on
Big
top
Show
of you.
Using me as the cushion.
Yeah, sure.
So the logistics of that one are tough, but I thought it was fine. I mean, this didn't light my world on fire, but it wasn't a bad match. And as you said, a tough handicap following.
I thought this was definitely way better than the main event, though.
Not going to disagree there.
Yeah.
Then we got the Hall of Fame recap, and this was the one time Vince McMahon's ever appeared at the Hall of Fame, at least the modern era. He did in the original days in the 90s, but he was there to induct Steve Austin, and it was symbolic of this Hall of Fame where Austin had his beer and handed one off to John Cena. And this was the year when, I mean, every year it was, is Austin going to come back? And I think when people saw they're in Texas, Austin's not wrestling, and with this kind of ceremonial, this symbolic handoff to Cena, a lot of people took this as his full retirement at this point. We were 6 years here since his last match. I think most people bought this as the end, but then years later, they were still clamoring for a return. They showed all the inductees and brought them out on the stage. We had the Funks, Bill Watts, Howard Finkel, Coco Beware, Kevin Von Erich, Ricky Steamboat, and Steve Austin. And then Austin walks to the back and his music hits and he returns on an ATV. And listen, this guy has some incredible driving skill.
He does.
I could never do this.
Oh, my God. The guy came out in this ATV, like, speeding down that ramp. Were there lights attached to both sides? He almost fell off the top, it almost felt like. But the guy was going straight down that ramp, around the ring twice.
And then up the aisle. And then goes in reverse.
Reverse back.
And was
back
not going straight in reverse.
Oh, God. So, I mean, just a huge ball of energy, even on an ATV, does the whole beer thing. Very fun to watch.
Of his skill set, that catching ability of the beer cans is really fucking impressive.
Good catcher. I mean, you got to credit the thrower as well.
Yeah, it's a team effort.
Yep.
He did some good old-fashioned drinking and driving.
He did.
Even had beer holders in his ATV to drive away after chugging however many beers. So,
yeah. It's attitude, man.
God bless Texas, I guess. So anyway, a huge reaction here for Austin, which I think is notable. Like this crowd, they got an incredible match. They still got up for Austin. And whether it was fatigue or whether it was lack of interest – the main event did not get this crowd back.
Yeah.
And that will be the story of the main event of this year. Ross says – we should also mention Ross says that you will never forget the night the Austin era began and the night it ended. And they did a toast with Jim Ross and Steve Austin as well. And I would say between that video package and then this kind of pronouncement by Jim Ross, who I think most would link as Austin's closest ally in wrestling, like this really felt like this was – closing the door on wrestling this night for Austin.
Mm-hmm.
Then we got a promo for the 25th anniversary of WrestleMania in Phoenix in 2010. Lillian announces a sellout crowd, and then the video begins for the main event. And the unfortunate part about watching this on the WWE Network way is I looked down at the time remaining, and it said 42 minutes.
Uh-huh.
For a main event I was not dying to see.
Well, you have to figure in, 10 minutes of celebration, maybe 10 minutes of entrance.
We were going to get all of that, but going to total 42 minutes.
Yeah.
This video became a short film into an AC/DC music video, culminating in Vince and Shane triumphantly returning on Raw, which we reviewed. And then we cut to Hunter in the back, walking with his title, and meets Vince and Shane. And they just gave a family nod to one another without any words spoken.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. They spoke grunt. Triple H, Randy Orton, WWE title, with the stipulation that if Hunter is disqualified or counted out, he loses the title. Let us recap that Hunter is coming to his family's honor after this guy, Randy Orton, kicked his father-in-law in the head, hospitalized his brother-in-law, forced himself onto his wife, and now we were going to have a pro wrestling match with rules enforced. A match that if this was the main event of WrestleMania, maybe this is the match that we have the hardcore stipulation, the violence. This is supposed to be, and granted, they were going to stretch this out till the next pay-per-view. I get that. But this is the WrestleMania main event. And this, I'm sorry, this thing died a death to me at the end of this 4+ hour show and going goddamn 24 minutes and felt much longer here. And I don't know what it is. I'm a fan of Hunter. I'm a fan of Orton. Together, these two, it's just like it's two agents that repel one another and don't have chemistry together.
Right.
And it just did not work to me. It's like they're too similar in their – I don't know. There's just something that doesn't click with these two to me.
They are too similar. Neither of them really are great at showing weakness.
To change it to this, it's like it's two play-by-play announcers when you need a great play-by-play and a great color guy to work off each other so that what one lacks, the other provides. And these two, to me, it's like their strengths are just too similar that they don't fill out an enjoyable match. I can go beyond WrestleMania. I've always found that with these two.
For me, it's kind of tough to buy Hunter as a sympathetic babyface.
That's another great point.
Because he's so strong, because he's so invulnerable, because he has the backing.
And he's got the prize.
Of the company.
He's not challenging. He's not trying to take something from Randy. It's the opposite. This is a really botched program to me. A botched WrestleMania main event program.
Right.
And to me, it's like I would have been saving a lot of the violent elements for this match because this was a violent personal grudge. Mm-hmm. And instead, we took all that shit away with the idea that maybe we'll get a DQ finish and a title will be lost because no one buys Randy beating Hunter clean. Lawler compares the WWE title to the McMahon's coat of arms and is one thing that Randy has not taken from the family. The WWE title. Hunter comes out, and for his entrance, he threw a sledgehammer through this pane of glass.
Yeah.
Maybe that was Austin's handing the glass-breaking entrance to him. Hunter, the match begins. Hunter stomps him in the corner, and he is warned by referee Scott Armstrong, "I will DQ you if you continue to stomp him in the corner." What a WrestleMania moment that would have been, right? "You have lost your title due to an excessive stomp." Orton then sneaks up and hits an RKO. Hunter then avoids a punt to the head and hits a pedigree, and both are down. Hunter takes some water and dumps it all over himself. Then he attacks the neck of Orton, and Orton stops Hunter by attacking his shoulder. Sends him over the barricade. There were just crickets here as Orton was in control. Hunter hit a high knee and a pedigree got blocked, and then Hunter was catapulted into the corner. Another pedigree gets countered into a jackknife cover. They fought on the floor, and Hunter grabs a monitor, and the crowd reacts to him about to use it. So you can at least say the audience understood the stip that this monitor could cost him the title and was the most engaged I thought they were up till this point in the match.
Or maybe they just wanted to see a man hit another man with the monitor.
Maybe they thought they were going to get blood because they did that monitor spot on TV ahead of time and bloodied – or Shane used it, right? Uh-huh. Yeah, at No Way Out, the match we reviewed. Hunter then fights back, stumbles into the referee, and the referee is down. So Orton throws Hunter – he throws him into Armstrong, who's now officially done, and Jim Ross just calls it evil as he hits the RKO. Orton then gets the sledgehammer, enters the ring, but as he's climbing in, Hunter recovers and he punts Orton in the head, which was like the big turning of the tables that they had been working towards this big spot that no one reacted to. Orton being punted himself, and Hunter then hits him with the sledgehammer, hides it, attacks him with punches, and then he's kicked him in the head. He has concussed the man. He's hit him with a sledgehammer, but one more attack. The pedigree, which does in Orton, and Hunter wins in 23 minutes and 34 seconds, and the pyro goes off, and in we go to the event montage to close the event.
Mm-hmm.
I thought a pretty poor – I don't even want to – like, this was not awful by the stretch of, like, our battle royal, but as a main event, like, this was a Hunter – main event at WrestleMania that died, and it goes into a collection of them that he's had this issue of closing out long shows, and just it wasn't the right position that year to be in.
Oh, how about that DVD? The Triple H failed WrestleMania main event collection.
Call the curtain.
Ah.
The Triple H WrestleMania story.
Call the curtain. Yes, certainly. And you could point to a number of factors why this match probably didn't work. It was a long show, first of all. You know, you're coming off of one of the best matches of all time at WrestleMania. You were coming off of a pretty good title match following this, too. And maybe the feud didn't necessarily click. The stipulation certainly hurt them.
Didn't click. Yeah, it's – listen, to their defense – they did learn – like this was still the point where they believed the title goes on last. That was the thinking for Hunter Jericho in 2002. And in this case, they thought, hey, it's our big program. It's the title. We're putting it on last. The following year, they at least learned the lesson. It was Michael's retirement. Mm-hmm. No title. It went on last and should have. Yeah. So you can at least give them that particular acknowledgement. So there you have it. That was WrestleMania 25. On a scale of 1 to 10, I think you really have to grade this. You have to take into account Michael's taker, which I think is where the positives of this show come from. I won't say an awful WrestleMania, but I would say a pretty damn disappointing one if you take out Michael's and taker, which was the high point of this, and Ricky Steamboat. Those were kind of the big ones to me on this show.
Yep, that was very good. I thought the Money in the Bank match was quite good too, and I liked the World Heavyweight Championship match.
This would have been a great 2-hour WrestleMania card.
Sure. I give it a good, very solid 7.8.
Wow.
Yep.
I go 7. I have a hard time being negative on a show that had a 30-minute classic like we got with Michael's taker. That is certainly the standout and one of the best WWE matches ever. So there. Go watch that match if you haven't seen it. It's good.
And go watch Kid Rock, everybody.
Yeah.
Does some great, great classics.
So hot.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to go to the message board and hear from you before we wrap this up. And we start off with McWhalen. I don't like to use hyperbole, but WrestleMania 25 is easily the most disappointing WrestleMania in my opinion and arguably one of the 5 worst ever. It was the first bad Mania since 2000, as 17 through 24 were all quality shows. The Hardy match and Jericho Steamboat were quite good. Shawn Taker is a classic. The rest of the show is either bad or disappointing. The main event of Hunter and Orton was particularly boring and easily one of the worst WrestleMania main events ever. I know you two are not fans of blood, but this was one match that really needed it to take it to the next level, as the PG requirement really dragged this match down several pegs. It was so bad that Hunter was taken out of the title picture and the Mania main event scene until 2016. Thankfully, WWE fixed the troubles of Mania 25 with its following pay-per-view, Backlash 2009, which is probably the best WWE pay-per-view of 2009. WrestleMania 24 gets 4 unnecessary Kid Rock concerts out of 10, mostly for the 3 quality matches, but the rest of the card was just a massive letdown performance-wise, and it ruined the show. Easily one of the 10 worst WrestleManias in my opinion.
We go to Kai, who says, I started watching wrestling in July 97, and I watched everything I could. As the years went on, I would have to skip the odd pay-per-view here and there, but the one show I always made sure to watch, usually live, was WrestleMania. This was the first year I happily skipped the show, and I'm glad I did. While Taker HBK was without a doubt a classic, the Hardys was just a fun brawl, and Jericho Steamboat got way more than expected. I think the only reason to watch the show was Taker HBK. The rest of the show was awful. You got 20-second squashes for the IC title, Santino winning a female battle royal, a pretty flat world title triple threat match and a boring main event, this is a bad Mania overall. I have a question for you guys as well. Is Triple H the unluckiest WrestleMania main eventer ever? While granted, he has been part of some good Mania main events, he's also been part of the clusterfuck at 16, followed by Rock Hogan at 18. He had to follow Rock Hogan at 18. He had to follow HBK Taker here, and he got a boring performance out of Roman Reigns last year. Is Triple H unlucky as a WrestleMania main eventer?
I don't call it unlucky.
No, not at all.
You know what? Financially, he's done fine on these WrestleMania shows, so let's not shed too many tears for Taker. Listen, in fairness to Hunter, he's had some pretty great matches at WrestleMania as well. I mean, the two Taker matches, actually three Taker matches he's had at WrestleMania stand out. The Roman match was just – it shouldn't have been so long. Like, that was just a dreadfully long match at a show where everyone was just zapped energy-wise, and they still went out for 30 minutes.
I don't even remember it.
There you have it. Okay, let's go next to Peter from Toronto. Thanks for the review, guys. Everyone knows Michaels and Taker was great. Let's look at the other good stuff. I was really impressed with Steamboat in the Legends match. Heck of an effort from the guy. I was really surprised CM Punk won the Money in the Bank again since his first world title run was handled so poorly. Glad he got a second chance. Pretty much the rest was disappointing. Orton and Hunter should have ended with Orton winning the title. Not surprised how the IC title was treated, since I believe this was its first WrestleMania title defense since Mania 18. Edge and Cena really deserve to have a one-on-one match at WrestleMania to end their feud once and for all. Question. There were two versions of this WrestleMania poster. The first one had Austin on it. The second one, they took him out. Were there plans for Austin to do a match at this show at the same time he was going into the Hall of Fame? And if there were, who would it have been against? I don't think it was ever to the point where people expected it. I think they were hoping for it, but I didn't – I'm drawing a blank in terms of how far things were along that they actually thought. Like, I'm sure a year out, maybe they thought it was a possibility given it was Texas, but I don't recall it being at any kind of level where people ever anticipated it.
Vince from Toronto. I watched the show live on pay-per-view, and it was the first WWE show I had seen in about 10 years. The Money in the Bank match blew me away. I had no idea what I was watching, but I loved every minute of it. That one match made me a wrestling fan again. Then the rest of the show happened. Apart from a surprisingly dexterous Ricky Steamboat, the rest of the show was either boring or confusing, not at all entertaining. I remember having learned two things from this show. One, Kofi Kingston is really exciting to watch, and two, half the roster should follow Bradshaw and retire because they're just too damn old and slow. 2 out of 10.
All right. Kirby from Toronto. He's essentially asking if the streak should have ended on this show. I say definitely not. This built the whole reason for the rematch the next year and then into the Hunter matches, and man, taking the streak out in 2009 – I think you're robbing years of that streak going on. You could argue if it should have ended in 2014.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we got a Terry from Mid Wales who says, "Welcome to my thoughts on the 25th annual."
Thank you.
WrestleMania. Oh man, if that felt good after this stupid anniversary talk. All right, the Taker Michaels at WrestleMania. One? Wait. Taker Michaels at WrestleMania is a bona fide big match classic. Challenging Austin Rock at 17 with massive kickouts and finishers after spots. It came off that Shawn could really end the streak with all the amazing mind games pissing off The Undertaker. Even though we all know the result, I brought into some of the near falls today. That missed catch by Deuce, was it Domino or Deuce, is horrific to watch.
Deuce.
And still, you can tell there was a legitimate concern for Taker not being shown on camera for a good couple minutes. Love the story, love the psychology, yet I feel this gets overlooked for the following year's match. In contrast, Triple H Orton came off as a quiet fart. Its intense blood feud culminates in a slow, plodding WrestleMania main event. I didn't think Hunter delivered the corrected, pissed off, but holding back champion attitude he needed to, and it was just his usual in-ring self. Also, why not clobber the bejesus out of Orton after the match for ruining his family the last couple of months? The crowd were burnt out clearly after Taker Michaels, with such a subdued reaction to everything from these two. But as good as these two are in the ring, I feel like they should have stepped it up, as both were easily capable of pulling off a better match.
And finally, we go from Mid Wales to South Wales with James.
Pretty much a one-match show, but a tremendous match that delivered on every possible level. Undertaker and Michaels put on an incredible show that pretty much sums up why I'm still a wrestling fan. Ricky Steamboat was crisper than 80% of the active roster. It was a pleasure to see a great talent perform again. Punk winning was a great moment both then and to relive. As a longtime Punk fan, it seemed he was finally going places after the previous year. Seems a 21-second squash has historical significance, too, based on the Mysterio match predating Goldberg by years. Yes. All in all, an enjoyable show at times, even if, as often happens, the last match is not worthy of closing the show compared to earlier matches. 55 John Cena lookalikes out of 100. All right.
Yeah.
That is going to wrap it up for our look back at WrestleMania 25. We're going to be back in 2 weeks on Friday, March 24th, and we were going to be reviewing the Raw the night after WrestleMania, but what happened was in 2009, the following week, they did a draft. So we are going to skip ahead and we're going to review Raw from April the 13th, 2009, a 3-hour edition of Raw back when they were few and far between.
Easy, no problem.
And we're going to review the draft special edition of Raw. So
and we'll have some drafts.
Yeah, we might need them to get through that particular Raw. A 3-hour Raw from 2009. And we are going to be joined by a former member of the WWE writing staff who was working with the company during this 2009 period. So
who?
We are going to be looking forward to be joined by Brad Corbett, who will be on the show with us, and he will be discussing this time period for the WWE in 2009. So that's going to wrap things up. And to end off the show, we are going to hear from an interview we conducted with Paul Bearer discussing the Undertaker's match with Shawn Michaels and his long run with the Undertaker. So here is Paul Bearer on the Law as we say goodbye. And we will chat with you in 2 weeks on Review Away.
It's getting kind of chilly in here, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the program. Live audio wrestling here on Hardcore Sports Radio, Sirius 98. Some excellent promo work there from our guest at this time, one of the most well-remembered managers of all time. He was involved in pro wrestling in so many different facets. Some of you might have remembered his early days as Percy Pringle, but I'm sure most of you remember him as Paul Bearer in the WWF alongside The Undertaker. And it's great to welcome him here on the show, Bill Moody, ladies and gentlemen. Bill, how are you doing tonight?
Doing great. How's everybody? It's good to be here.
Great. We're doing very good, sir. Thanks very much. We just thought it would be great to have you on the show because WrestleMania last weekend and Taker was involved in the huge match with Shawn Michaels. And you worked with Mark Calloway for so long. In fact, the two of you actually worked together in, was it Texas before the WWF?
Yeah, I was his first manager in his first match. In the business at the Sportatorium out in Dallas, and I think that was about 1987, maybe, and so we had a little history there.
Did you?
Before we were put together, in WWE.
Did you think even from those early days that he would become the star that he did? Could you see it right from the start, or was he kind of the diamond in the rough back then?
Oh, absolutely not. It was a complete diamond in the rough. No, we didn't have a clue. No clue at all.
Can you, explain for the listeners, for the fans, how it did all come together? How did Paul Bearer and Undertaker become that great force back in, back in the early 90s?
Well, it was the wrestling in Dallas, World Class Championship Wrestling, was closing down at the time. And we're talking about, it was December of 1990, and I was going to leave and move back home to my home in Mobile, Alabama. And a lot of people don't know I'm a legit mortician.
Right.
I have a degree in mortuary science, and it's always been wrestling and funeral service for me ever since I was a kid. Well, anyway, long story short, I was getting ready to leave Dallas, so I'd been there 6 years, and moved back home to Alabama. And I happened to speak to one of my good buddies, Rick Rude, at the time, and Rick Rude told me, he says, no, don't do that. He said, you just hang on. And I'll call you back. Don't do anything drastic until I call you back. So it was about the same day, same afternoon, he called me back and said, you got a pencil and paper? Yeah. He said, write this name and number down, which I did. And it was Vince McMahon's phone number. He wanted me to call Vince. And I called Vince. We talked briefly. He set me up a flight, flew up to Stanford at the old Titan Towers there, and had a meeting with him there. And it was pretty weird because at the time, Vince didn't know about my history in funeral service.
Right.
Vince didn't know that I have a degree in mortuary science. He was aware, of course, of my background in the wrestling business, because I'd already been in the business 15 years at that time.
Right.
And I didn't know that Vince was looking for a manager for The Undertaker. So it was kind of weird when we finally came to the, you know, when we talked and he realized that I was a mortician and I realized he was looking for a manager for The Undertaker. It was just a match made in heaven. It was just meant to be, and it happened, and the chemistry was just there, and yeah, I was just blessed.
Yeah, I mean, what was going through your mind when this guy approaches you to play basically a mortician? I mean, you must have just thought, wow, the gods are smiling down at me. I mean, what better person to do the job?
Yeah, well, I didn't know. I left that meeting. I'll never forget the day. It was December 22nd, 1990. And the reason I remember the exact date is because that was me and my wife's wedding anniversary, was December 22nd, so I won't forget the date. but when I left there and after the meeting, I came home with a contract in hand, because I was still living in Dallas. I arrived back home in Dallas with a contract in hand, but I didn't know at that time, still that, you know, about the Paul Bear character, and that's what I was going to be doing. About two weeks later, J.J. Dillon called me and kind of went over briefly, you know, what they wanted me to do and wanted me to color my hair and this, that, and the other, wear the black suit, and I was going to be managing The Undertaker. And I wasn't, you know, I was really excited about, you know, getting the bump up to WWE or WWF back in those days.
Right.
But my God, talking about two different ends of the spectrum, being the bleached blonde Percy Pringle for all those years.
Right, yeah, because that the Percy Pringle character was kind of your arrogant rich guy kind of thing, right?
Yeah, and you know, with the blonde hair,
yeah,
and everything, and then going from that to the, to the black hair, black suits, pasty white. Oh yes, you know, what two different ends of the spectrum.
It is,
and it was pretty difficult transition there at first. But like I tell a lot of people, you know, once I got that first check, it was all downhill. It was all downhill from there.
How did you make the transition, and how did you make Paul Bearer so unique? Like the interview style that you used, and like where did all that stuff come from? Where did you draw?
Truthfully, back in those days, you know, there wasn't any scripted interviews or anything like that, like they do today. Like I said, I'd been in the business 15 years at that point, and Vince had a lot of confidence, you know, in myself and Mark himself, and pretty much all that stuff in the early days just was off the cuff. It was just things that, you know, it just kind of happened. I use the word a thousand times during, you know, when I talk about things like this. It was a blessing. It was just meant to be. The chemistry was there. I'd known Mark, you know, a few years prior to that time, and so we knew each other, and it was just meant to be. It was just the perfect recipe, thank God, you know.
It was.
People find it hard to believe, but it was just there.
It was. No, it absolutely was. And, you know, after years and years of doing that voice, did you ever have any issues with your throat? I mean, I would try to imitate you for, like, a couple minutes, and my throat would be sore. Was that a tough one on your voice?
And that was another thing. Nobody ever told me, you know, Vince never, or anybody, any of the creative staff at that time, nobody ever told me that, you know, that's what you wanted me to do or anything. It just happened.
Yeah.
You'd watch the old horror movies with Boris Karloff, you know,
right.
I started doing the, and I didn't do the voice right away.
Yeah.
It kind of developed over a period of time. When I started doing the segments they had, they called the funeral parlor. That was
right.
A segment that I had.
Yep.
And it just happened. It just happened.
It was amazing.
It was a blessing.
There's no doubt that in those early days of the Undertaker's character, there's no way it would have gotten over as strongly as it did without you doing the promos. I mean, you were such an essential part of those early days of the Undertaker.
Well, I appreciate that, and we certainly had a damn good time.
If you had to sit back and pick some of your favorite moments working or favorite angles with Taker, what would have some of them been? What ones really did you enjoy?
Man, they were all good. They really were. We had a long run, you know, with the Ultimate Warrior there for a while early on. Where we locked him in a casket, you know, in an airtight casket. He couldn't breathe, and they used sledgehammers and drills and busted him out to save his life. And then he wasn't breathing. They had to do CPR to bring him back. And then, you know, and we carried that all around the world. We done body bag matches with him,
yeah.
Matches with him, and just it was just natural.
Did you guys have trouble working with him? Because he's always been portrayed as a somewhat temperamental kind of guy, the Ultimate Warrior.
I didn't. Mark certainly did. But I never had to wrestle him.
Right.
But I had a history with him, too, because I managed him early on in his career when he, you know, when he started out in Dallas, too. Back during that time, he was the Dingo Warrior.
You're right, right.
And I managed him back then, and... We knew each other, and I never had a problem with him, you know, never, ever once had a problem with him. But Mark had many sleepless nights.
Was that because he didn't enjoy working with him in the ring, or?
Well, it was just Jim. That was just the way he was, and he was kind of hard-headed a little bit, I guess, and he liked to do things his way, and. But eventually, you know, as we went around, like I said, we worked with each other so many times and so many different matches and gimmicks that things came around there too, and they eventually had a meeting of the minds and things went well, and it turned out to be a great angle, which we worked with so many guys, you know, like Yokozuna and Kamala and Jack Roberts and I can just go on and on and on.
What? How did you feel about the addition of the Kane character when we had kind of the whole dynamic of, you know, what it changed quite a bit. I mean, brothers and you were the father and all that kind of stuff. How did you feel about the addition of Kane?
Well, that was something that me and Mark, you know, kind of came up with ourselves. You know, during our travels, you know, of course we talked, you know, and we were trying to think of something that we could add to kind of spice it up a little bit. And me and Mark came up with the idea of the brother, you know, and the name and everything. We didn't know, we didn't have a clue who it was going to be. It was just
right.
We would toss around, you know, on the road, and off times in airports and while we were driving around. And then just by chance, we went to Smoky Mountain Wrestling, you know, for Jim Cornette to do a few shows for him. And there we met Glenn Jacobs, who was the Unabomber at that time.
Right, that's right.
Yeah, and Mark had a couple matches with him up in Smoky Mountain, and there it was again. The chemistry was just there. We just hit it off. He was a great guy. And when we went back, you know, to Stanford, it kind of, we took his name with us. And they started using him out, you know, using him and some of the crazy stuff. You know, he was the dentist, Jerry Lawler's dentist, you know.
Yeah, Isaac Yankum.
Isaac Yankum,
that's
you know.
Right.
And then he had played a couple other things where he was the fake Diesel, I guess.
Right.
And, And then it just it fell right into the place with the Kane scenario, and it just worked.
Yep, never looked back.
You know, I mean, sometimes when I tell any stories, I make it sound like it was easy, I make it sound like it is easier than what it was. It was certainly a lot of work, but it was there. The chemistry was there. It's like making a cake. All the recipe, all the ingredients were just there, and we put them in a pot, stirred them up, and stuck in the oven, and it worked.
It did.
Thank God it worked. Oh yes.
excuse me, Bill. I have to ask, what do you think has been the one? Like, why has the Undertaker's gimmick lasted so long, endeared for so long? I mean, he's from another era, yet he's still considered one of the top guys here in 2010. What is it about the Taker gimmick that it keeps people coming back?
I think the basic of it all is Mark himself, the type of person he is, the tremendous athlete he is, and tremendous gentleman and businessman that he is. And all through the years, you know, he continuously changed, and that certainly added to his longevity. He became the American Badass there,
right,
for the while, and just changed, you know, his look and all that added to it. And gosh, it's just hard to believe. It's been so many. The years have just went. Whew.
It's true.
You know, here we are, almost 20
yeah.
years.
Yeah. Yeah.
20 years ago, like you had asked me earlier, did we have a clue how long it was going to last or what was going to happen? 20 years.
Yeah.
My God. I mean, nobody can touch that.
That's absolutely. Very impressive.
I just can't say it. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, did you get to see the match with Shawn and Undertaker at WrestleMania last weekend?
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely.
And
for sure.
It was a great match. I thought the two of them, it was just as good as their match the year before. When it comes to retirements in wrestling, they're always a little dicey, for sure. Do you think Shawn Michaels will stay retired?
Well, you know, with the history of retirements in our business, you know, it just doesn't usually happen. You'll see a guy, look at Ric Flair, for example. I'm not talking bad about Ric at all, because I've been a Flair fan for years and years, and I still am.
Right.
But gosh, look how long his retirement outlasted.
I know, not very long.
I think that Shawn, you know, will be away for a long, long time. But I would certainly never say never, because sooner or later there's always an idea that pops up that would bring somebody back. And I wish him all the best. He certainly needs the time off. He certainly needs the rest. He certainly deserves it. But it's I would not be surprised if he didn't pop up again, you know,
yeah,
a year or two down the road. It's just the nature of the beast when it comes to our business.
It's very true. It definitely seems to be hard to stay away. On the other side of the coin, we have the Undertaker streak. I mean, it means more in wrestling today than any world title means, or like it's the one concrete kind of thing, it seems, in pro wrestling, because everybody just doesn't care about titles anymore.
No.
Do you think the streak will ever be broken, or should it ever be broken?
Well, I don't know. I mean, at this point, if I was certain on the creative team or anything, and I don't have any insight at all when Mark's going to be ready to retire, I don't think it's going to be anytime soon.
Right.
Because we're still dear friends, and we still communicate. He still enjoys the business, because it's the kind of business that if you don't enjoy it, you just can't do it.
Sure.
You you got to have fun, and you know, if it ain't fun, I don't want to do it. And he's kind of the same way. He still enjoys, you know, having fun. But after all these years and all the injuries, and he's had some major problems with his hips, you know, over the last year or so. And I don't see him retiring, you know, anytime soon. But you know, Mark's Mark, but when he decides to go, it's going to be his time. But I don't, you know, as far as the streak. Why ruin a good thing?
Sure.
Why?
Sure. No, absolutely. Did you ever think there'd be one more time when Paul Bearer might get a chance to accompany Taker to the ring?
Well, like I said a second ago, never say never. I would never say that it would never will never happen. And if the time's right, the opportunity's right, and everything's right, you just don't ever know. You know, it's because that piece of the puzzle is certainly still there.
It's you never can tell with professional wrestling.
No,
that's for
no,
sure.
And I won't say that it won't happen because you just don't ever know.
All right, Bill, I want to thank you so much for joining us, talking to us at this late hour. You're doing the K&S WrestleFest next Saturday. Could you tell the fans a little bit about that and what that involves?
Yeah, I haven't been doing anything wrestling-wise for almost 4 years. A lot of folks know about my wife's health. My
right.
wife has had breast cancer twice. And just a year ago, I lost her to cancer. She passed away on January 31st of 2009 due to cancer after she had battled it twice, and then it just came back again. So I really haven't been doing a lot of things with wrestling. I play around with independent wrestling a little bit here on the Gulf Coast where I live. My youngest son wrestles on the indie scene, and sometimes I'll manage him now and then. But I haven't done anything major at all in almost 4 years. So I'm going up to Carteret, New Jersey. It's right outside of Newark there. They're having one of those Legends deals up there this coming weekend. Well, I'm flying out on Friday. The actual convention on Saturday. The
right.
10th, which is my birthday, by the way.
Oh, happy birthday.
There's a lot of guys that's going to be there. I'm going to think I'm going to have a nice little birthday party next weekend. While I'm there, so I'm looking forward to seeing a lot of the guys, and a lot of the fans, and so I'm starting to do a little bit more of those things that I haven't done in a long time. I went to Atlanta 2-3 weeks ago, and done a Legends convention there, in Atlanta, and had a blast doing that. And it was kind of a test for me.
Right.
It's really what I want to do again. I'm really excited about doing these conventions and stuff, and I'm not really happy about flying too much anymore. Because flying used to be so much fun.
Yeah.
It's just so hard. You know, y'all know how it is. It's just so hard these days to enjoy flying anymore. Because
yeah.
The nature of the beast.
It's a ritual nowadays, for sure.
But I'm looking forward to doing some of this stuff and doing some indie shows, you know, a little bit more around the country. And I have a website I've had for, gosh, probably about 8 years now, percypringle.com.
Right.
A lot of old stories, a lot of old pictures on there. I have a blog that I keep up on a regular basis. I've even started playing around with tweeting a little bit.
Whoa.
That's something new for me.
Paul Bearer's on Twitter.
Yeah, I'm just starting to learn about that. But all my stuff's under Percy Pringle. It's percypringle.com,
right.
And I'm Percy Pringle on Twitter, and... But we still love it, you know, after all these years. I still keep my finger on the pulse of the business, and we still love it and always will.
And one last question before we go. Have you ever thought about putting together a book or something? I mean, a career like yours.
Oh, yeah.
You worked with so many great stars early on.
Oh, right, I have. And I'm still under a Legends contract with WWE. As a matter of fact, they just extended my Legends contract. You know, they've been cutting them things left and right, cutting guys loose, but... Just here, just a few weeks ago, they extended mine, which was really
nice.
A surprise to me. But I've been doing a lot of things in the background. I've been working on some new video games that are going to be coming out. I done Raw versus SmackDown 2011 that'll be released in the fall. I done that last month.
Nice.
And just past Friday, they flew a couple guys in to meet with me and do some recording and stuff for something I can't even talk about. They asked me not to speak about. I guess kayfabe is still alive.
To a certain degree, yes.
But, so I'm still, you know, I'm still playing around with it a little bit. And as far as the book goes, there really is a book. And then the book comes out, you know, WWE is the person that's going to be the person to be the people to print it because of the Legends contract. They have the first option on it. But like I say many times, that last chapter hasn't been written yet.
Yes. All right. Well, Bill, thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to...
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure.
All this stuff in the future. And fans can check you out next weekend at the K&S WrestleFest. And, of course, check out your website. It's percypringle.com. All right.
Exactly.
All right. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you so much, and y'all have a great evening. Y'all do a great job.